As we approach the end of the year, you may be finding that you need some additional continuing education to maintain your certification or license. Maybe you don't have it, and maybe you do, and it's just a big pain in the butt to get it together. You're tired of clicking through lots of different certificates to claim half an hour here, an hour there, digging through the conference website, whatever. You know what you could do? Go to the Intensive Care Academy. That's Brian and my other digital project where there's tons of educational content in the form of videos, a couple private podcast feeds, and more. We think it's good education, but it's also a good way to get your continuing education. We've got CME that's usable by just about every license type. It's about one of the cheapest rates you can get it for in general, but in addition to being cheap, it's really easy to use. A couple clicks to claim your whole year's credit. I'm in the same process, and I can definitely appreciate that. So go check it out if you haven't, ICU101.com, and see what you think. On to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I am Brian Bowling, and with me as always is Brandon Odo.
You.
We are going to do a little bit of talking about seizures today, some neuro stuff. And one of the things I think that always gives people pause with seizures is most people in emergency medicine and critical care, I think, are comfortable with breaking seizures, right? With benzos and stuff. But what do you do then? There's lots of different meds out there. Which one's the best and why is it just always Keppra? And so we thought we'd talk to an expert. And so we got an old friend, Tom Black, to come on the podcast with us. If you are not familiar with Dr. Black, you have been living under a rock because he is the guy in neurocritical care. He's a professor at Northwestern, but he's also the founding president of the Neurocritical Care Society, which I've referenced multiple times on the podcast. He's a master of critical care medicine through the Society of Critical Care Medicine and just all around smart guy. So welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Thank you.
So let me just tell you about a patient who's, you know, could be found probably in any hospital across America today. Let's say it's a 69-year-old female. Perhaps she has some medical history, but nothing really contributory today. Lives alone and was, I guess, in her usual state of health until the UPS man came to her home today. And he saw her through the window, acting bizarrely. She came to the door and she didn't seem normal. So they call an ambulance. EMS brings her to the ED there. And there, while she's getting her initial screening and triage, has a witnessed episode of generalized convulsions. So the ED team comes in. They say, oh, this is a seizure. And they reach for a benzodiazepine, which I think we all understand is generally our first line agent. But let's just take a second and break this down a little bit because I think everyone's doing things a little bit differently and oftentimes maybe just out of habit. So I'm going to first ask you about drugs. Which benzo should we reach for? And just say, does it matter at all? I think it's fair to say that many of us are out of habit using primarily lorazepam, but I don't know if that's for any particularly compelling reason. What do you think?
So if you look at the results of the trial that compared intramuscular midazolam to intravenous lorazepam, okay, the Rampart trial, if patients don't have an IV, they actually get seizure control faster with IM midazolam because you don't spend the excess time starting the intravenous line.
So in the select group of people where you don't have any access, there is an answer to this, which is yes. IM midazolam.
Right. So the dose that was used in the study was 10 milligrams IM, could be repeated once, whereas the lorazepam dose of 4 milligrams also could be repeated once. The midazolam group was statistically more likely to stop seizing and stop seizing more quickly. But that difference is really the time that was spent starting the IV. So if you look at the time from the actual drug administration, then the IV lorazepam was faster. There wasn't an IV midazolam arm in that study, so I can't suggest that IV midazolam is better or worse than the others. A lot of emergency departments now are just using IV midazolam, but there's really no data, at least no published data about it. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that either benzo will control about 65% of patients who are in generalized convulsive status. This patient had what sounds like a prolonged focal seizure with altered awareness prior to having the convulsion. And one of the main problems in all these studies is that we don't really know when people actually started seizing. For most studies, we only know from either the time that EMS was called or the time that EMS arrived, which leads us with a lot of uncertainty as to how long people really were seizing, and do the people who don't respond to the benzo constitute a population that was already seizing for a long time. We know that seizures that began from the moment they start, you start losing the benzodiazepine-sensitive GABA-A receptors, and they're being replaced by benzodiazepine-insensitive GABA receptors. So the tachyphylaxis to benzodiazepines in status is primarily the loss of the receptors that will work on benzos, whereas people who are just getting benzos for sedation don't seem to lose their receptors. There's some compelling evidence now that the problem there is because once the NMDA receptors get activated, the increase in intracellular free calcium with activation of calpain-2 is probably the reason why these receptors are being swapped out. So that will lead us to another consideration later when we think about the folks who didn't respond to benzos. But from the first line, I think it's fairly well established now that either IM midazolam, if there's no IV, or IV lorazepam, if there is one, would be the first line.
I want to circle back to the drugs, but now you've raised an interesting question, which is, should we, if it gets harder and harder to break seizures, which of course is true, should we generally do it as soon as possible? And of course that is generally true, but many simple seizures will stop on their own. So if somebody is at home who has epilepsy, you know, many seizures don't need to be treated, they'll break. My general approach in the ICU, and I can't quite speak to the ED or maybe the hospital floors, but most of our patients are high enough risk that if somebody has a witness seizure here, I'm just going to assume it's probably not going to stop. And if it happens to stop by the time I have a drug that I can push, then fine. But I'm going to plan to treat it. Do you think that's reasonable? Or, I mean, should we be waiting a certain amount of time to treat, particularly when we're talking about higher risk, more sick patients?
So if you look at seizures that are timed where we know, say, in an epilepsy monitoring unit, we know when they started, most of them are going to end within about 90 seconds. Now, in the ED and the ICU, if you don't know when it started, then you should probably assume that it's been going on longer than 5 minutes, which is our current trigger for treating status. If you do witness the onset, again, most of them, even in the ICU, are going to end on their own. So if they do end on their own, then giving a benzo just adds to the sedation and potentially respiratory dysfunction. Although, to be honest, respiratory dysfunction from an anti-seizure dose of either IM midazolam or IV lorazepam is vanishingly rare. That when we looked in the ESET trial, which I'm sure we'll get to later, the main reason to get intubated was because you went to an emergency department where they intubate a lot of people. And it wasn't dependent on any of the drugs that were in the randomized trial. The other reason, of course, to intubate somebody is to get an ICU bed right away.
So let's say we watch somebody seize on the unit. If you know we go get a vial of something and we attach it to an IV, if we happen to be under 5 minutes from the onset, maybe wait for 5 minutes, but as soon as we hit 5 minutes and 1 second, we should treat it.
There's no proof of that. It's a concept that we think is correct. If the seizure continues, then it seems reasonable to do that. My own concern in that is whether you're looking at somebody who's still convulsing, in which case you ought to, or they just haven't awakened yet and they're no longer convulsing. And we don't know at this point how many of those people are now just in a state of electrical mechanical dissociation where their brain is still seizing, but their body's not. Usually we think that takes 30 or 60 minutes to develop, but in an ICU where you might be dealing with somebody who's already got severe brain injury, we don't know the answer. We hope to get a partial answer to this in the upcoming KeySET trial, where we'll be using a rapid EEG system as quickly as possible to get a handle on whether people who stop convulsing but then don't wake up right away are actually still seizing, or they're just postictal, or it's the effect of the drugs, or the effect of whatever the cause of the seizures was.
So it sounds like if you have intravenous access, lorazepam versus midazolam versus perhaps other benzos, diazepam, there's no data for. But in the absence of data, I mean, what do you think? What do you reach for? I mean, I tend to use lorazepam, but I could see a case for midazolam, you know, pharmacologically faster onset. Doesn't last as long, too, and maybe that's a good thing. It's nice when people wake up if they did stop seizing. If they didn't stop seizing, maybe that's not a good thing. I don't know, but
I think in either circumstance, if they don't wake up, you need some sort of EEG to tell you what's going on. And for all the people who say, you know, well, we didn't have this for 100 years, we've just been giving drugs. Well, you know, we didn't have thrombolysis for stroke, and we didn't have stenting for MIs either. So rapid EEG systems are now at least four on the market, are something that people ought to consider having available. They don't replace a regular EEG, but they do give you something you can attach within a few minutes and get a quick answer.
So what benzo do you use?
I use typically lorazepam, but that's because I'm working in the hospital where almost everybody has an IV.
Do you think it's better than midazolam if you have an IV?
I don't have good data to tell you that. I don't mind if people give midazolam, you know, but, you know, I always have a bag valve mask system available if for some reason I need it. So. Okay.
All right. So that's the drug. Let's talk dose. You said 4 milligrams has been studied. Practices I've seen vary from 2 to 4 or perhaps more. What do you think we should be using for the first dose?
Well, so I think it differs as to whether you're in the pre-hospital setting or in the hospital. So what's been studied in the pre-hospital setting has typically been aliquots at 2 or 4 milligrams of lorazepam or 5 or 10 milligrams of midazolam. I think, though, in the hospital, we should fall back onto the results of the old VA cooperative trial, where lorazepam was given at a dose of 0.1 milligrams per kilo without a cap for weight. And there were no more incidents of respiratory failure or other complications at that dose than there were in the pre-hospital studies. So if I'm in the hospital, you know, if the way the guidelines are written now from both the Neurocritical Care Society and the American Epilepsy Society, it says to give a 4 milligram aliquot and then you can give another one. So I would say you can start with 4 milligrams once in a while, that's enough. If not, give another 4 milligrams, assuming that your patient weighs more than 70 kilos. And if that doesn't work in a couple of minutes, then go ahead and give the rest the 0.1 milligrams per kilo. It appears from old studies that giving more than the 0.1 milligrams per kilo doesn't improve the efficacy of the drug. So when you get to that point, then if they're still seizing, you're going to go on to something else.
So if you were bold, you would just say give everyone 0.1 as a single bolus. So in a canonical 70, let's say nowadays, maybe 100 kilo patient, that's going to be 8, maybe 10 milligrams of lorazepam at once, which sounds like there's data that is relatively safe, but seems like a lot to a lot of people. Now, you hedge that and some of the guidelines now say maybe you split it, give like 4, then maybe 4, maybe even a third, you know, if there's still something left based on body weight, if they're 150 kilos or something like that.
Yes.
How long in between then? Slash, what are we looking for?
Yeah, so it's another good unstudied question. The likelihood that it's going to work has been saying, well, if it hasn't worked by 6 minutes, it's probably not enough.
6 minutes after the first dose, not...
Correct. It's hard to sit there and wait 6 minutes before you give the next dose. And it seems like it's taking forever. So I usually am going to give the next dose at about 3 or 4 minutes, recognizing I may be giving more than is going to be necessary.
And we're looking for them to stop twitching or whatever it is they were that looked like a seizure.
Right. Once in a while, you'll see somebody, you know, I have plenty of EEG recordings where we gave 0.1 milligrams per kilo and they woke up within minutes. So there I know when the seizure stopped and when they woke up. Some of them wake up very abruptly, but in the intensive care unit setting, you're often dealing with somebody who's obtunded or comatose before they start seizing. And if it wasn't due to subclinical seizure activity, then they're not going to wake up suddenly. And again, without an EEG, you have great difficulty sorting out where you are. But once you've stopped the convulsions, you probably have diminished the likelihood of further brain damage. I wish we had good data to back that up, but that's sort of how people are looking at it right now.
Right. They haven't woken up. You don't know that they're still not seizing non-convulsively, but there's a fair enough chance that more empiric doses of a benzo are probably not needed, you know, assuming you can hopefully get something like an EEG done in a reasonable time.
Right. That's what we think now. Could be different next year.
Okay.
So would the same principle apply if, let's say, they have general convulsions, right? And you give them a dose and they stop convulsing, but you look and they still have, you know, gaze deviation, nystagmus, some little minor signs. Would you consider that still clinically seizing and good?
I would, yes. So in the days when phenytoin was the major drug that was used, we commonly saw people who went from generalized convulsion to having fairly minor but still quite visible twitching movements of one sort or another. And when we would hook them up, they would always still be in status, just not convulsing anymore. So if you do see those minor signs, I would still treat them as if they're continuing to seize.
Okay. And then if you were going to use a strategy and you were a midazolam fan, if we kind of use a rule of maybe double the dose of lorazepam, would you say, oh, we'll give 8 or 10 milligrams repeat if they're still convulsing up to a max of about 0.2 per kilo?
Yeah. So now this is if you're giving it IM, but hopefully after you give the first IM dose, you're starting an IV. How much you should give intravenously, we really don't know.
So one argument against midazolam is just we don't know as much about it.
Right.
Okay. And then we kind of talked about the sedating effects of these drugs, but you said, and I you know, clinically, I think I would agree, in general, while pure benzo sedation makes people sleepy, it doesn't generally entail a lot of complications. They usually keep breathing. They usually preserve their airway. And therefore, we shouldn't necessarily shy away from these drugs because of that risk. And maybe what that entails is if we knock somebody out with a bunch of lorazepam, they stop twitching. We don't think they're still seizing. That's still an open question. But if presuming they're not, we shouldn't necessarily go and, let's say, intubate them because they're really sleepy.
Right. Well, the first thing I would do that is often forgotten is turn them on the side, right, so that whatever secretions or blood is in their mouth will roll out instead of being aspirated. Right. So that so-called rescue position, commonly taught in first aid classes, suddenly gets forgotten when you go to work in the hospital.
Yeah.
Our only solution is tubes. And that's true. I mean, we often kind of proceed directly in that direction, assuming everyone who doesn't wake up needs an airway. But now it probably depends on what's going on, right? In more complex patients where this is maybe just part of their picture and one symptom of, let's say, their massive intracranial hemorrhage or something like that, it may be a different matter. But if it just seems like more of an isolated seizure, maybe they're sick for other reasons, but there's no particular reason to think that they won't be able to manage their airway and keep breathing until this drug wears off.
Right. And the other thing is you can always put in an oral airway. And as they wake up, then they'll spit it out. But
so there is then this question of they stop twitching, they're not awake. Are they just sedated / postictal, or are they still seizing? And generally, the answer to this is EEGs. And then there's always the just practical matters. what would you do if you have no immediate access to any form of EEG in that patient?
So if they're not waking up, I would then move on to one of the three drugs that were used in the ESET trial. And the response to these drugs, one being levetiracetam at 60 milligrams per kilo, valproate at 40 milligrams per kilo, or fosphenytoin at 20 milligrams per kilo, all had about a 46% response rate in people who continued to convulse after they got the benzo. But I would apply that as a reasonable choice for the patient in whom they're already critically ill and I want to try to prevent them from having another seizure. In terms of the differences between the drugs, we published some tables of which ones seem to work better at what age, but the study was not powered to prove that one is better, say, in young people versus older people. If somebody wants to look it up and make a drug choice on that choice, that's fine. But in general, now that levetiracetam is available in a syringe to be pushed, instead of having to mix it in a bag and drip it in, I think most people have gone to levetiracetam. I think, did I say lorazepam? It should be 60 milligrams of levetiracetam. There might be reasons in a given patient to make a different selection based on drug problems they may have had in the past, but even if they're in renal failure, you can still give the same loading dose of levetiracetam. You just don't give your subsequent doses as frequently.
I want to sink more into these drug selections, but it's always been a little unclear, even in some of the guidelines, when you introduce, you know, these anti-seizure medications. And it sounds like you're saying the only time, especially in a sick patient, like in the ICU, where you would not go from your benzos to an anti-seizure drug is if they are clearly waking up already. So if they're either still convulsing or not convulsing, but they're not awake, you should probably give them something.
I would. Now, as rapid EEG becomes more readily available, that recommendation could easily change. I think, you know, the other side of it is, what's the underlying pathology? So if somebody, you know, has a recent intracerebral hemorrhage, you don't want them to have the blood pressure spikes that go along with the generalized convulsions. So you're perhaps more likely to put that person on propofol and maybe intubate them just to get more rapid control. Or if they say have a spinal fracture and you think they're unstable, it might be worthwhile doing something that is going to be more definitive as far as preventing the next seizure.
Right, yeah. So if you have EEG right there, or they're already on, it's like continuous EEG, then you can maybe treat things differently if you can prove they're not currently seizing. And that opens the question of, should we still give them something to prevent another seizure? But that's a different question from essentially breaking status, which is what we're talking about.
Okay.
So let's talk about drugs. So now that we have, I mean, that's not recent from the ESET trial, but we've proven that levetiracetam seems to work as well as more traditional agents. As you said, people really have embraced, I mean, they were already embracing it, but because it's easy. And so for all of the people, especially who don't do this every day, let's say outside of neuro ICUs or the ICU period, is there ever a time when you think this was the wrong choice? Now, maybe there is a more elegant or maybe slightly more ideal choice in somebody. But should we ever not reach for levetiracetam? Let's say a patient who's already on it, can we still give them the same dose? Let's say, I don't know, like you said, specific pathologies. Is it ever wrong?
I don't think it's ever wrong in this setting. In the long term, people on levetiracetam seem to have more behavioral problems. So it might be that you'll want to switch to something else. But in the acute setting, I don't see any advantage to valproate or to fosphenytoin. I should mention a recent paper that was in Critical Care Explorations done in the out-of-hospital setting in which patients who failed a benzodiazepine, in that case actually midazolam, immediately got ketamine, and they claimed that they had a response rate somewhere in the 90% range of their patients who then stopped convulsing when they got ketamine. So we're about to start a trial called KeySET, where we will take patients who failed benzodiazepines. This will be in the emergency department, comparing 60 milligrams per kilo of levetiracetam to that dose of lev plus 1 milligram per kilo of ketamine, compared with that dose of lev plus 3 milligrams per kilo of ketamine, to see if ketamine at sub-anesthetic doses has a reliable anti-seizure effect. Animal models suggest that it's a robust way of dealing with the problems that come from excitatory amino acid release into the synapse. There's lots of case series data now suggesting that it's a reasonable drug in the third line. The question is, should we move it into the second line? Or if this paper from the pre-hospital setting works out, maybe it'll be something that we start in the pre-hospital setting as well.
So this is distinct from using ketamine as part of a package of general anesthesia in the patient we've intubated. This is before that, along with maybe our second round of benzos as an additional drug to try to stave off going that way.
Right. So the 1 milligram per kilo dose of ketamine, again, these are single doses, not infusions, is modestly sedating, and the 3 milligram per kilo dose gets into the so-called dissociative range. Of course, these are already people who've been loaded with benzodiazepines, so we don't expect them to have emergency reactions. Probably the worst thing that will happen in this setting is you'll get sialorrhea and end up giving them glycopyrrolate. But we'll find out. We're just about to start.
So let's say someone's reaching for levetiracetam. The dose in ESET was 60 milligrams per kilo with a cap at 4.5 grams, 4,500. Is that the dose we should just always use? I've seen some data back and forth. Maybe less is okay, but is that always the right choice? Best data for it? Is there ever a time you would reduce it or give more?
So in terms of people who weighed more than 75 kilos, so they would exceed the 4,500 milligram cap, if you really stuck to 60 milligrams per kilo, a lot of them stop seizing. We don't have any seizure drug levels to guide us in those patients, but it's likely that there's a smaller dose that's going to be effective, but it also didn't seem to have any toxicity that would stop me from at least giving them the 4,500 milligrams. If we had better data, I would pare it back, but for now, we don't seem to have any evidence that it is bad to give that 60 milligram per kilo dose. It probably also, by giving a bigger dose, gets a larger amount into the brain faster than the person who gives the traditional 1 gram to see what happens.
So in the interest of simplicity, sort of the ACLS of seizures, telling people just give 60 milligrams per kilo up to 4.5 is probably a good answer for just about everyone.
Right. And then you can look at their renal function and decide when to give the next dose.
So our next line here is, general anesthesia, which requires an airway. And again, I think there's always a little question of kind of when to go here. Is it a fair summary of how you've been breaking this down to say, if a patient is still convulsing at this point, you should intubate them and we'll go to one of these other drugs. If they have stopped twitching, then we can probably wait for an EEG to prove that there is now non-convulsive status before going that way, if there is EEG available. If there's no EEG anywhere to be found in the county, that's maybe a different question. But
I think at this point in time, you could go in either direction. We don't actually know how many of those people who aren't having any minor seizure manifestations are actually still seizing. Hopefully, as rapid EEG gets more widely disseminated, we'll be able to determine this. But for now, my own choice would be to go ahead and intubate them. There are people who say that you can give a moderate dose of propofol in this setting without intubating them. There's a series that's been presented from the Montreal Neuro of a fairly large group of patients over 20 years in whom giving them somewhere around 25 to 50 mics per kilo per minute of propofol controlled their seizures without requiring intubation. I think for non-anesthesiologists, you would likely run into a lot of complaints from your anesthesia colleagues if you tried to give somebody 50 mics per kilo per minute of propofol without intubating them. But depends on your local setting. In terms of which drug to prove, it's been very difficult to show any difference between propofol and high-dose midazolam, which would be the main choices. Over the years, people have tended to go more toward propofol because when you start to decrease the dose, you have a more reliable drop in the effect, whereas a day or two of midazolam, now you've got so many active metabolites that you can't measure. It's by itself going to be a long withdrawal period. Of course, if you're worried about propofol infusion syndrome, then you're more likely to choose midazolam.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about drips in a second. But just to clarify intubation, you would intubate if they still had clinical signs of seizure. You would not if there weren't. They're just not awake.
I would try to get the EEG as soon as possible. But yeah, I might watch them for a while, recognizing now, that the dose of benzo that they got at the start is likely still going to be sedating for the next couple hours.
In a center that had no EEG, and hopefully these are less common now they have more of these rapid devices, but there probably are still places where there's just no EEGs. You could use that strategy. We'll watch them, see if they wake up. How long should you do that before you start talking about transferring them to another center or some other solution where they can get an EEG?
I don't think I'd wait very long, so I'm thinking maybe an hour is reasonable.
Because they could still wake up after, but at that point, if they are still seizing, it's too long.
Right.
We're going to intubate. Do you think it matters what drug we use for induction? You know, sometimes people will try to tailor this to say, oh, this will be a nice thing to add on to help break seizures. But of course, it's just a one-time drug. Do you think this is worth giving a lot of thought to, especially if it's going to compromise the intubation, you know, using a drug you're less comfortable with, for instance?
So every drug that's been suggested for rapid sequence induction, as far as I can tell, has reasonable anticonvulsant effect. All right, so even etomidate has been studied in the past as a anti-seizure drug. It worked pretty well. If you ended up on an etomidate infusion, then you got adrenal suppression. Single dose etomidate, you probably get some, but it doesn't, for example, seem to be necessary to give steroids to supplement after that. I suspect in the future that ketamine will become the intubating drug of choice in this setting, but you know, a good slug of propofol or even a barbiturate will all work just fine. On the other hand, we will occasionally, say once a year, see somebody who gets succinylcholine as a neuromuscular junction blocking agent. And because they have some underlying neurologic or muscular disease, they get a severe, sometimes fatal hyperkalemia from a depolarizing blocker. So you would typically, in this setting, try to use a non-depolarizing blocker. Since rapocuronium went off the market, then you know, I have to keep in mind that the non-depolarizing blocker is going to last longer than the anti-seizure effect of the intubating drug. So if somebody, for example, in the extreme case, were to continue to have seizures under neuromuscular junction blockade, you would likely see tachycardia, hypertension, and pupillary dilation. And if they were suddenly awake under neuromuscular junction blockade, you'd see tachycardia, hypertension, and pupillary dilation. So you want to supplement a dose of things like rocuronium with some other sedative agent during that time.
Right. As we talked about in a recent episode, maybe this would be a good situation to reverse the paralysis if you really want to be able to see if they're doing something. And maybe it doesn't matter too much what drug you do. Maybe we'll rule out the one case of giving no sedative, which hopefully is not too common, but I can imagine someone saying, oh, this patient's super out of it anyway. Right. We'll just paralyze them or not even do that. Probably a good time to sedate them regardless.
Right, because like all those sedative drugs are going to have an anti-seizure effect for them.
All right, so after that, you're putting them on a drip, and it sounds like of the most common alternatives are propofol versus a benzo, probably most commonly midazolam. You think either is probably equally effective, at least for the evidence we have, and people can kind of pick what they're most comfortable with or in the setting of other situations like their hemodynamics or what have you.
Right. So if you're going to use midazolam, it's important that you give a loading dose of 0.2 milligrams per kilo and then start an infusion at 0.2 milligrams per kilo per hour. But because of the tachyphylaxis to it, you may have to raise that dose every hour or so. And without an EEG, it's very difficult to know. So if I were not in a situation where I had EEG available or had somebody to look at it for me frequently, I would probably choose propofol just because there does not seem to be tachyphylaxis to propofol.
And would you load propofol, and what rate would you start the drip?
Loading is a tricky question because I don't know what their blood pressure is right now and how they're going to respond to it. So the initial trials of propofol for refractory status suggested you could load with 3 to 5 milligrams per kilo, which I basically would never do. So I would probably start an infusion at about 80 and see what happened. I might have to back off for blood pressure. I probably wouldn't start higher than that.
Circling back to, well, let me just clarify that then, because some people who are not used to using high doses of propofol like that would go lower. They just put them empirically on 30 or 50 or something. That might be a little light without the benefit of something like EEG especially.
Yeah, but it's very hard for me to predict what's going to happen here. So if somebody wants to start at 50, that's okay. 30, I kind of think like, well, that's maybe a dose for somebody who's not intubated.
Right, okay. And then circling back to ketamine then, maybe we would never use this as the first line anesthetic, but when do you think there might be a role of adding this as a adjunctive drip here, and maybe in dissociative doses?
Yeah, I think at this point we are going to it more and more frequently. We started using it because of the sympathomimetic effect, hoping to get an increase in blood pressure in people who are getting hypotensive because of the other agents. But it seems to have a very worthwhile anti-seizure effect at the anesthetic doses. That's what the trial is to see if lower doses will still be useful. But I think you could easily, you know, start somebody pretty much where you wanted to. So if a general anesthetic dose might be, you know, a total of maybe 5 milligrams per kilo over a half an hour, that'll allow you to do abdominal surgery if you need to, by the way. It's always an interesting conundrum there because so much general surgery in the rest of the world is done with those doses of ketamine on the notion that they protect their airway reflexes. But then you use it as an intubating drug. Maybe it's just the neuromuscular junction blockade that allows you to intubate them. But without getting into that argument, I think, you know, you could start pretty much at any dose you want and look for an effect.
Then the question becomes, you know, this patient is settling down. Hopefully we have EEG available. And now we're going to be titrating anti-seizure medications as well as our anesthetics. I want to talk about kind of where to go with the drugs. But first, let me just ask, assuming we have a continuous EEG applied, how often should we be reading this to guide our care? And this is a practical question because the people who can read EEGs are a little hard to come by in many centers. And then it comes up like, how closely are they being monitored? I mean, is it often enough for someone to look at these once a day? Which raises the question, can you just do a spot EEG once a day then? Should it be several times? Should it be every hour? What do you think?
So I think first it depends where you're starting. So if you've got the EEG hooked up and now you've gotten control in somebody who's gotten, say, levetiracetam and maybe one other conventional anti-seizure drug, which a lot of people want to do before they go on to a general anesthetic regimen. I don't, but a lot of people do. then you're really watching the EEG to see if seizures are recurring. Right. So then it doesn't really matter what the background activity is. All you want is to be alerted if there are seizures. Some of the rapid systems have software that supposedly alerts you to it, but you have to understand that what is considered a seizure electrographically might not be a strong enough seizure to change your management. So the American Clinical Neurophysiology Society's definition of electrographic seizure activity is to have more than 20% of a one-hour epoch with epileptiform activity in it, but doesn't specify seizures in the sense of things that evolve. I think that's fine. It's based on a study in children in whom, if they had more than that amount of epileptiform activity, their neurologic outcomes were worse. So there is something to that. But in terms of should I change a level of general anesthesia, especially if I'm already having trouble with blood pressure, because of that, as opposed to a real evolving seizure, I probably wouldn't. Right. So even though the machine might say status epilepticus on the screen, that wouldn't lead me to change what I'm doing. On the other hand, if we're in the stage of super refractory status, where we're using general anesthetics to completely stop seizures, say for 24 hours, when you're first starting, you probably want to aim, depending on the drugs you're using, say if you're using propofol or barbiturates or even an inhalational agent, you probably want to aim for a burst suppression EEG with about 10 seconds of suppression between the bursts. But if you're using midazolam or ketamine, you basically aren't going to get to burst suppression. And a study from Germany published last year showed that only about a fifth of the patients in whom they thought they were aiming for burst suppression ever got there, even though they got seizure control. So I think seizure control is really the issue. But when you're first starting the drug, if it's one of the drugs like propofol or general anesthetic, then burst suppression is a reasonable place to start, that you've given hopefully enough, and then watch for seizures. Most EEG systems now allow the data to be read remotely. So I think in that setting, if you can't transfer the patient, you'd be better off finding someone who's willing to look at it remotely. Now, I'm lucky enough to work in a place where the EEG techs who do the epilepsy monitoring unit observation also look over the EEGs from the ICUs. So they're always being looked at. A fellow has to get up every couple hours and review everything and may call the attending if there's something they're not sure about. Or if there's no fellow, then the attending has to get up. So far, there's no good way to get around the fact that somebody really needs to look at it.
So it sounds like in places where that are less well-staffed, they don't have such dedicated teams monitoring the EEGs, the frequency that they should be assessed, or maybe that ICU team should push for them to be assessed, probably depends on where they're at. You know, are they still in a dynamic state where you're trying to achieve something like seizure cessation and burst suppression? Have they reached such a state and now it's just a matter of making sure that they're still there? Are you weaning, that sort of thing?
Right. So it's clear from older studies, though, that burst suppression will only control about a third of the patients. They may need to have a completely flat background in order to stop their seizures. On the other hand, we don't know that having 1 5-minute seizure in a day rules you out from trying to wean the drugs. As if they were out walking around, you wouldn't even admit them for that seizure. So a lot of things we don't understand and need to figure out better.
Okay. All right. So now it's a matter of what we do. Let's say they are having more seizures that we think are important. Let's say we had started with the levetiracetam. Let's say we put them on a propofol drip. Now they're reading it and saying, you know, they're having prolonged periods of status still, probably non-convulsive at this point, but nevertheless seizures. Where do we go from here? Let's say we increase our sedative and now we're assessing our seizure medications. Would you, in general, first increase the dose of whatever we'd started with, in this case, levetiracetam? Would you add another agent in most cases? And if so, we can talk about what to add. But
yeah, so I don't actually go but that much higher in levetiracetam anymore. In the past, I had gone up to 6 grams a day. I don't think it produced toxicity except when status ended. The patient was really mean. And tapered it down and he was fine. I think having other alternative things to add may be useful, so that if you're looking at somebody who has new onset refractory status, the so-called NORS, they're actually looking at going very quickly to things like anakinra and tocilizumab as anti-inflammatory agents, because these patients tend to have large elevations of IL-1 and or IL-6. If there's a likelihood of, or a possibility of any vitamin deficiencies, it looks like having very low levels of vitamin D are a marker for people who may get better with vitamin D replacement. That's early on in the study of that vitamin, but turns out, at least so far, it looks promising. In terms of other things, I very quickly now go to the ketogenic diet for people. There is a paper suggesting that there's some bad interaction between ketogenic diet and propofol, but in my ignorance, I've done that a lot of times and never seen it as a problem. The main problem with the ketogenic diet is you need a nutritionist and a pharmacist who are dedicated to getting all the carbohydrate out of the feedings and the drug infusions. Like, you don't often think about how many of the drugs you give are in D5. Mm-hmm. Got to get rid of that. There are suggestions as to what your beta-hydroxybutyrate concentration should be to be effective, but they change from year to year and author to author, so it's worth picking one and going with that, I think. Should you add in other conventional anti-seizure drugs in an attempt to wean off the general anesthetics? I think, you know, we had looked at ganaxolone, a neurosteroid, as a way to do that. It's probably no better than any other GABA agonist. So even though it's available for some unusual congenital neurologic problems, I wouldn't be adding it to this setting anymore. But a lot of my partners are enamored of starting clobazam as a way of trying to wean off the general anesthetic agents. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
So you would generally not have more than one anti-seizure medication on board?
Assuming I'm continuing levetiracetam, for example. When it comes time to wean the general anesthetics, I would start weaning it, and if seizures recur, go back up and then add another conventional agent.
Then you would add. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think you could make an argument that you should have two or three on board, but then as you start to wean the general anesthetics and you know, your liver enzymes go up or they get a rash, then you really don't know what to do, right? So you're better off. When we used to use phenytoin, for example, a lot of people would get a rash from a loading dose of phenytoin. Did we have to stop it? Well, we always did. But I think if you throw in phenytoin and get a rash, you don't know whether it's the phenytoin or something else you did. So
if, let's say you had started with levetiracetam, what would, you know, barring other specific considerations, what would often be your next second line?
Probably valproate. A woman who's potentially pregnant, you wouldn't give valproate as a chronic drug. In terms of a ESET situation, by the way, there's no evidence that a single loading dose of valproate has been associated with neural tube defects. So, we, for example, an ESET did not screen for pregnancy, but we wouldn't continue it if we knew someone was pregnant. In terms of fosphenytoin, I think it's still a reasonable drug. In ESET, it was the drug most likely to be associated with quote-unquote required intubation. But that had much more to do with what center you went to than it did with the actual drug. So,
how do you feel about phenobarbital or lacosamide?
Good choices. Lacosamide is probably underdosed in this setting. You probably want to load with 10 to 13 milligrams per kilo following the PR interval. I use a lot of phenobarb in the patients who are very difficult to control, but you're basically using it at a general anesthetic dose to start with and then slowly tapering it off. So you want to load with 20 milligrams per kilo, which in most people will give you a certain concentration around 20, but you may have to push that to 100 or 150 in order to wean off the propofol or the midazolam. People, oddly enough, will wake up even though they're getting certain concentrations of 150 mics per ml. Takes a couple days, but they start to adjust to that effect. I think we've had a lot of people in whom nothing else seemed to work, but works pretty well. The half-life of phenobarb with normal renal function is about 120 hours. So if you're going to make a dosage change, you either have to give another loading dose or expect that it's going to take a long time to reach a new steady state. Phenobarb is a little faster. It's 90 milligrams per kilo, but one of the pharma bro companies bought the license and raised the price from $8 to $180 a vial. So I may load with it, but then quickly switch to phenobarb.
So it sounds like it's fair to say that, especially when we start talking about third, fourth, fifth line anti-seizure medications, there are going to be some particular considerations that may make one maybe a better or certainly a worse idea in some patients. But outside of those, you can kind of use whatever floats your boat, whatever you're more comfortable with, whatever you have more experience with. Maybe you have anecdotal experience that was good for here, bad here, whatever. But it's hard to say that anything is better or worse. The last thing I'm curious about, and maybe this can cycle us all the way back to the start of things here when we're talking about benzos and anti-seizure drugs and intubation and things. What about the patient who's not having generalized seizures? They're having more focal seizures. We used to call partial seizures. You guys kept changing the names. But like maybe they're having some kind of clinical manifestation that's clearly not generalized. Maybe they're awake, but you know they're arm is twitching or something like that. And maybe this is prolonged, meaning it's technically status. Do you think we need to be as aggressive treating such people? And if no, then how much less?
Okay, so I think the one end of the extreme is the person with epilepsy partialis continua whose thumb is twitching. It's been twitching for 5 years. If you give them general anesthesia, it's the last thing to go away and the first thing to come back. And other than having them on some chronic anti-seizure drug to prevent generalization, I wouldn't try to abolish that. People who have what used to be called complex partial status or temporal lobe status or focal status with altered awareness, the International League Against Epilepsy has suggested that, well, maybe if they go on for 10 minutes rather than 5, you should start treating them. I think there's very little data on which to base that as opposed to generalized convulsions where we have a lot of preclinical data and some clinical data to really tell us we need to be more aggressive there. So there I would be unlikely to start with a benzodiazepine. I would probably start with one conventional anti-seizure drug. Again, usually levetiracetam out of convenience. Is there a time when they ought to go on to general anesthesia? I think probably not. And then there's one very special case, so-called absent status, which you can only recognize with an EEG where they have the same 3 per second spike and wave discharge that kids with childhood absence do. As best we can tell, that's a hyperinhibitory phenomenon and doesn't cause any damage no longer, no matter how long those seizures go on. And there, usually a benzo will terminate the current episode, and then ethoxamide, which only works for absence, is actually a good choice. unless they have GI intolerance, and then valproate also works well.
So it's probably fair to say that the more generalized a seizure is, the worse it is, and the more focal it is, the less significant, and therefore to, you know, adjust your treatment and aggressiveness in accordance. But there's not really, you know, clear cutoffs or, you know, obvious, definite recommendations for where to go on which things. It's a spectrum.
Right. So once in a while, somebody with, say, an acute stroke or an intracerebral hemorrhage or trauma, often in an area where there's a hematoma or some contusion, will have focal seizures coming out of there. And again, it's worthwhile having probably one standard drug on board to try and decrease the likelihood of them generalizing. But it may be very difficult without going to highly sedating regimens to stop their seizures. And I will sometimes have to let them continue their twitching or whatever it is they're doing, rather than trying to over-sedate them. And the other thing, of course, is source control. So if you're dealing with something that ought to be removed, like a tumor, go ahead and do it, even though they're still in status. So there is a fairly large literature now on surgical resection, even for areas that are probably focal encephalitis or cerebritis that won't respond to anything else, that do respond to removing the focus. And also, people have been using a variety of electrical systems. So either the vagal nerve stimulator has worked in some folks who have prolonged focal problems. Responsive neurostimulation, we're actually putting either strips over the cortex or deep electrodes in, has worked. And there's been a small study from Stanford looking at transcranial direct current stimulation that they're trying to get a good trial going. So there are a lot of things on the horizon that can be useful, but these ought to be done in epilepsy centers.
All right. Brian, what else should we talk about?
Well, we've mentioned a couple things, and you just mentioned one, you know, with these more advanced treatments and stuff, but we keep talking about the lack of EEG as being a good reason to get somebody to a bigger center. But in general, if let's say you're just a home crit guy in a med-surg ICU in a community hospital somewhere, at what point, other than I really wish I had an epileptologist or, you know, somebody other than teleneurology, at what point should I consider transferring a patient in status or just with multiple seizures to a neuro center, to a neuro ICU somewhere?
You mean assuming they do have EEG at least available?
Yeah, assuming like you can get the basics at your place, but at what point?
EEGs.
Yeah, at what point are you sort of like starting to get out of your depth and this guy should really be at a neuro center with specialists?
I think a couple of things. One is, if you're, say, using propofol and the patient starts seizing again whenever you try to wean it, that's probably a point at which, even with EEG available, you should consider transfer. The flip side is, what's the patient's underlying condition and what's their general health like? So I think somebody who's got a limited prognosis for some other reason, you probably don't want to transfer. But in most circumstances, we're happy to take those transfers. The outcome is often much better than you might expect. So a large retrospective look in the English language literature suggested that even people with super refractory status had about a 35% chance of returning to their baseline. Also, 35% of them died, but it's, you know, I think 35% is often a pretty good percentage for people who have real critical illness. So.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tom. What, anything else you want to leave us with, especially for those of us who are not doing this every day, maybe in that smaller center, maybe in a more general ICU setting? We certainly see seizures, but it's not really everyone's bread and butter.
We've been funded for the QSET trial, and despite the current disruption in Washington, that we got the next batch of money, so we're going to start enrolling probably in November. So if you have the opportunity to have a patient who might qualify, because you have to be in the same town, it would take too long to transfer somebody from another city. It's something that, if you have people who've had seizures, to make them aware of, It's done under exception from informed consent. So there's a lot of community notification going on right now. And also, hopefully, will give us information that, you know, in the next 5 years we'll be able to give you a real answer about ketamine in that setting.
So if someone wants to know if there's a nearby center who's enrolling for KSET, just what is there, a list somewhere?
Go to KSET.org. You can get all the information about the trial.
Well, we can wrap things up there. This has been, I think, a nice look at the depth and breadth of especially the practicalities of this process, which people often talk about in kind of vague terms, but when it really comes down to it, there's a lot of decisions to make. So I hope this has been enlightening. Please remember, these are just our general thoughts. This is not specific advice for any of you. And we're not representing our own centers here, just our own brains. And we'll leave it to you there and talk to you next time.